Immigration, elections, new laws, challenges to natural resources. What were the top stories in Texas during 2019? That's our focus for this special edition of The Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio, with support from Rand Group. Software delivered as promised. No surprises.
I'm David Brown. On this New Year's Eve, we're refocusing the rearview mirror on the year that was. We'll hear from Victoria DeFrancesco Soto of the LBJ School at UT Austin, Brandon Rottinghouse of the University of Houston, and Lauren McGaughey of the Dallas Morning News as we begin an exploration of the topics that shaped Texas over the past year. Weigh in with your picks for the year's top stories on social media, and make sure to turn it up as our year in review gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard Time on this final day of 2019. I'm David Brown. We're so glad to get to spend a bit of time with you on this New Year's Eve. Now, if you were with us about a week ago, we were listening back to some of our favorite stories of 2019. This hour, however, we're on a different mission. It's our review of the top stories of the year that was, a look at 2019 in the rearview mirror, you might say. We begin with some of the people who've been thinking and writing about this year as it unfolded in real time. Familiar names to longtime listeners of this broadcast, to be sure, and in no particular order. We have Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, who is Director of Civic Engagement and lecturer at the LBJ School at UT Austin, here in our studios. Hello there, Victoria.
Hello.
Brandon Rottinghouse is Professor and Pauline Yelderman Endowed Chair of Political Science at the University of Houston. Professor Rottinghouse, good to talk with you again, sir.
You too, David.
And Lauren McGaughey, investigative reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Lauren, good to see you.
Happy almost New Year.
Indeed, and the same back to you. All right, so how do we begin this 2019 year in review? I mean, I suppose I should note here that we will be talking about some of the major border and immigration issues a little later in the broadcast. Maybe we should, although it was such a big story this year, I mean, would you say, and I'll just throw this out, do you think immigration might be the top story of 2019, or is there something else that eclipses that one? I mean, there's a lot to go through here.
I think immigration has been the top story since 2015, when Donald J. Trump descended from the escalators and announced his candidacy. So I think it has just been one of the biggest issues in Texas, in the nation, also globally. So I think this is a trend that's continuing. And spoiler alert, it's going to be the same thing for 2020 as we are going to go into another presidential season.
Yeah. Do you see it that way, Lauren?
I mean, it was definitely a huge issue this year, as it's been in past. But I think sometimes on the ground in Texas, there were these huge events that eclipsed them totally. I know we're going to be talking about the mass shootings that we experienced this year.
Well, we may as well mention it right now. I mean, you've introduced it, and it certainly did make national headlines.
Well, and that's what I'm saying. I think, you know, immigration seems to be on everyone's minds all the time, almost the way that healthcare has become such a top issue to people, like constantly in the back of their minds. But these shootings that we had this year, and, you know, in the past 2 years, we've had four mass shootings here in Texas, 65 people dead just in those four, not to count if you know, brought in and out a couple of months, we got a couple more in there. And
now, just to be clear, so the people recall, we're talking about El Paso
and
Midland,
Odessa.
Right, that was this year.
And that was just, those were both in August, too. So it felt really concentrated. Mm-hmm. You know, it felt just like all of a sudden, all eyes were on this issue here in Texas. Lawmakers got involved. The people on the ground were asking for different things than we've seen them ask for in previous years with Sutherland Springs and some of the other big shootings. So it just felt like that sucked all the oxygen out of the room, at least maybe until we got to impeachment at the end of the year. People were talking about that. But I felt like this year was really marked by those mass tragedies.
You know, Brandon, the calendar comes into play here because these two shootings that Lauren was talking about there, El Paso and there in the Permian Basin, came shortly after the Texas legislature ended its session. And immediately thereafter, there were calls for a possible, you know, emergency session to deal with issues or questions of gun control. Let's look back at what the Texas legislature did try to address, though, when it came to that question, because people were talking about going into that session, doing something more to harden schools because of what happened in Santa Fe just a few months prior.
Yeah, this has been a real challenge for the GOP and is definitely a pivotal point for Republicans in sort of presidential and statewide politics. The governor and state leaders focused on doing things with respect to mental health solutions and ramping up school safety, like you say, kind of hardening schools. And that's typically the response. Anything related to actually sort of making it more difficult to buy or to possess guns typically gets ignored in a Republican legislature. But the politics of that are really changing. We have majorities now in the state that want stricter gun control laws. They want universal background checks. Fewer people have no opinion because these events have really, I think, crystallized thinking about this. So especially for suburban women, there is a huge shift in terms of support for gun control. And that's really going to be a political issue for the GOP going forward, because I don't think this is going to be the last time it happens.
You know, you mentioned the suburbs, and a lot of people are looking at 2018 and the election cycle there, and noting that the suburbs could really be the battleground in the upcoming election. We're talking about a demographic shift that's taking place across the Lone Star State. And Lauren, you're nodding.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a lot of this up where my mothership is, the Dallas Morning News. Mm-hmm. The suburbs of Dallas have changed radically in the last few years and in the last decade. And, you know, outside of Houston as well, we're seeing some shifts. And when we look at 2020, which I know we're going to talk about, those are where the Republicans are really worried about losing some key seats. Democrats are just 9 seats away of taking control of the Texas House. They got 12 last time. They feel like they're on a roll. There's kind of feels like there's all eyes on that issue.
Victoria, what do you think is happening with the suburban vote?
Right. So let me go back squarely to 2018. And we saw the sweep of Democrats, moderate Democrats, come in to the state legislature and also in our congressional delegation. We also saw a lot more women and a lot more diverse candidates really win those seats. And getting back to what was the year of Texas politics in 2019, we have to look at what happened in 2018. And the bottom line is elections have consequences. So 2019 in the state legislature was marked by no drama-ish. Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. We had the normal
far
drama.
Less, far less.
Yeah, ish.
But there were no, like, bathroom bills.
There were no bathroom bills.
These social hot-button issues.
Or the immigration bill that mm-hmm. was passed before them, and some members going to call ICE on other members. I mean, there was just so much drama in the 2017 session. And that was because the Republicans knew that they didn't have the wiggle room to play around and to go for those hardcore social moral issues. They knew that they needed to roll up their sleeves and show that they were a party that could do and didn't necessarily have to play to that extreme base because of the suburbs, because they see that moderate, independent women who vote, because women, we outvote men consistently, mm-hmm. were watching. So it all comes back to the consequence of the election. And if I were a betting woman, I would say that come next year's election, mm-hmm. the state legislature is going to gain more Democratic seats, looking at all of the Republican retirements. I'm not going to say it's going to flip, but there is going to be more strength for the Democrats to hold on more to a moderate line.
Now, hold that thought, because we're going to be looping back at the year that's forthcoming in tomorrow's big broadcast. So you want to stay tuned for that. But I want to get back to something, Victoria, that you were talking about, and that was the low drama Texas legislative session. What they did accomplish was noteworthy, and they really did focus on funding for Texas schools. And they also tried to deal with the issue of continually rising property tax rates, too, when that was a priority for the governor. This was made possible in large part because of someone who was rather highly celebrated at the end of that Texas legislative session, one Dennis Bonin, the new Speaker of the House. And then it all came tumbling down. Lauren, what happened?
Yeah, I was making notes on this morning, and I kind of said it went from the kumbaya session to the It was just completely out of the blue. If you haven't been reading up on what happened to the Speaker of the Texas House of Representatives, he's fairly young. He's in his 40s, but he's one of the longest serving members in the House. He's been in there since he was a young man. He rose through the ranks. He's always been kind of a back room wheeler dealer, really smart and effective kind of junkyard dog for previous speakers. And his speakership, his first year, his first tenure, was marked by all of these big accomplishments where the top three, the governor, lieutenant governor, and himself, they celebrated these tax bills, these teacher pay and pension bills, pre-K. And then just right after the session, news breaks that he had a sit-down secret meeting with a far-right conservative activist who heads a group called Empower Texans. And this man does not like the speaker. So the fact that they were even meeting in the first place was kind of a surprise. But then, you know, lo and behold, it comes out that this guy had the whole thing on tape, the whole meeting. And it really threw a lot of people for a loop because of the way the speaker was talking about his fellow members, about his fellow Republicans, people he potentially wanted to target.
And the upshot is that Bonin has decided he's not going to be... He's not going to be running for re-election. And so we're going to be looking for a new speaker come the next session. Brandon, do you think that any of that stuff sticks with lay Texans? I mean, people who aren't following this stuff 24/7, or are you more likely to be sort of taken up with what happened with Beto O'Rourke and that sort of drama?
I think it matters, at least to some degree, because you get to see how the sausage is made, and it is not pretty, right? I think a lot of voters look at this and say, maybe it's time for some new blood. And so Democrats are using that as a wedge against Republicans by saying, you know, they can't be trusted. And Republicans, as Lauren implied, are using it internally to say that we need new people to kind of promote a more conservative agenda, one that's not going to be so corrupt. So I do think it's a political issue. And some of the things that came out of that suggested that Republican unity wasn't what was expected, right? That the presumption was that the speaker was going to unify the party and Greg Abbott was going to kind of help cement that. But this blew that all up. It also blew it up in a profound way to say that there were some things that came out, like the fact that they implied that they wanted the next section to be really bad for cities and counties. So there's a policy implication to this too that I think has long-lasting implications to how the Republican Party is seen and how they govern.
Brandon Rodinghouse, professor of political science at the University of Houston. Lauren McGaughey is investigative reporter for the Dallas Morning News. Victoria DeFrancesco Soto, director of civic engagement and lecturer at the LBJ School, University of Texas at Austin. On this New Year's Eve, we're looking back at some of the biggest stories of 2019. And there's a whole lot more ahead. Stay with us.
Support comes from Texas Children's Hospital, focused on outcomes and care, and providing treatment to kids in the Lone Star State and beyond for more than 60 years. Texas Children's Hospital, personalized care for every child. More at texaschildrens.org. Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown, and we hope you're having a happy last day of the year. We're in time machine mode today, looking back at the top stories of 2019. You know, back on Election Day, you know we had one of those this year, remember? Some 80% of voters approved a measure called Proposition 5. It was an amendment to the Texas Constitution to provide funds earmarked for Texas state parks and historic sites. Now comes what could be, in some respects, the harder part, spending that money wisely. The Texas Standard's Michael Marks looks at what's in the budget.
For Justin Rhodes, the passage of Proposition 5 means he can finally step off the fiscal carnival ride.
It gives us a sense of stability and funding and gets us off that roller coaster.
Rhodes is the deputy director of Texas State Parks. The roller coaster he's referencing is how much money the legislature would allocate to his department. All of the sales taxes from sporting goods collected in Texas are supposed to go to his agency and to the Texas Historical Commission, but that hasn't always happened. In the nearly two decades Rhodes has worked for Texas Parks, state lawmakers have made a habit of raiding the department's budget to pay for other priorities. But Proposition 5's passage makes it harder for them to do that, which means a more predictable and a more ambitious parks and wildlife budget.
We have a list of projects, a list of priorities, and it gives us the ability to aggressively begin chipping away.
Many of those priorities are not glamorous. Many of the parks date back to the 1930s, with infrastructure to match. The state's parks are more popular than ever before. Rhodes says they're being loved to death, but they also have a backlog of over $800 million in deferred maintenance. So fixing and replacing infrastructure will be a major focus. Projects like replacing the wastewater system at Pardinalis Falls in the Hill Country, building a new headquarters at Tyler State Park, and repairing a communications building in the Davis Mountains. Just north of Houston, the boat docks and fishing piers at Lake Livingston State Park have needed to be replaced for years, but there just hasn't been room in the budget.
And the project's been on hold, and that's an example of a project that will be able to move forward.
And in addition to repairing and refurbishing current parks, Rhodes said that Proposition 5 could accelerate development of new properties. The department already has plans for two new parks that have been unopened for years because of financial restraints: Palo Pinto Mountain State Park, about 80 miles west of Fort Worth, and Albert and Bessie Kronkoski State Natural Area, 45 miles northwest of San Antonio. Those would be the first new parks the department has opened since 2012. For the Texas Standard, I'm Michael Marks.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider committed to helping companies protect their drivers on the road. More at worksafetexas.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. As we mentioned earlier in the big broadcast, this past legislative session was deemed by Texas Governor Greg Abbott, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, and Speaker of the House Dennis Bonin as the year of the teacher. And the signature plan included a multi-billion dollar school finance measure that included pay increases for teachers and other members of staff. For those in line to get pay bumps, a welcome gesture from state lawmakers, perhaps. But now comes the hard part. Who gets what and how much exactly? How do you actually apportion those raises? Well, after the bill's passage, we sat down with Noel Candelaria. He is president of Texas State Teachers Association, and we asked him what the new law says about how much teachers are entitled to and if all the teachers are entitled to one at all.
They're entitled to a pay raise, and what that pay raise actually is dependent on two things. One is a portion of the formula that the legislature allocated, but then also what districts are willing and able to do on top of that. So, the legislature, out of the $6.5 billion new dollars that are going into public education, they've got to take 25% of that, and then take that 25%, 70% of it has to go to teacher pay raises,
okay,
teachers, nurses, librarians, and counselors. The other 30% has to go towards all the other full-time employees except administrators. And so what we're seeing all across the state is anywhere from 2, 3% pay raise to as high as, 8%. So it's all over the place.
Why is it, or how is it, that school districts are coming up with such radically different numbers? Are they just deciding to divvy the pot in different ways?
Well, I mean, I think what we're seeing is the formula and what the districts are getting in new money is vastly different across every school district, depending on what allocation they were given as a school district. And so some districts, because they're fast growth districts, have additional resources because, their property rates are expanding, and they've got more property value, and so they're able to do more on top of what the state actually allocated.
Now there is a baseline, though. If you are a teacher in the state of Texas, you are, correct me if I'm wrong here, you are assured to get how much of a percent of a pay hike?
There is no actual percent.
Oh,
there is not. And that's where the formula comes in, because depending on what the average teacher pay or what the teacher pay is in that specific school district, it's going to vary all across the state.
So it's not just the amount, it's the actual percent that varies too.
Exactly. And so because the law was very specific on teachers with 6 years or more of experience getting a higher pay raise than those that are 0 to 5, so that's why you're also seeing a vast array of different pay raises all across the state, and how they're differentiating the pay between teachers that are new to the profession and those that have a little more experience.
I see. Well, what are you hearing from Texas teachers and from school districts more broadly?
Well, I mean, school districts obviously, are frustrated because it's still not enough. When they cut $5.4 billion back in 2011, the 6.5 has not even filled, you know, the gap that was created the back loss. In 2011. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, while, you know, the districts are grateful, the teachers are grateful that we've actually helped, you know, close that gap. Teachers are still, you know, they're grateful, but there's still a lot of room to catch up. You know, teachers in Texas before this session were $7,000 below the national average. And so we're seeing pay raises anywhere from, you know, $2,500 to $3,500 more than they were making last year on average. Uh-huh. And that is still significantly behind the national average.
No, wait a minute. I thought, I seem to recall that there was a proposal, sort of across the board, $5,000 pay raise for teachers that had been discussed during the legislative session. That didn't happen?
That did not happen. The lieutenant governor came out right out of the gate with a $5,000 promise to pay teachers more, but never actually allocated the funding to pay for it. And so the House had to come back and figure out how to actually pay for, you know, an actual real teacher pay raise.
So where does this leave us now? I mean, the legislative session is over. There's not going to be another one until 2021. What does that mean as a practical matter?
What we've been doing and what our members have been doing all across the state is showing up to those school board rooms, you know, and getting those school boards to find the additional resources to actually give them the pay raises they deserve. Because a lot of them have been flat for 3, 4, 5 years, have not gotten a pay raise. And on top of that, health insurance costs has continued to go up. So what our members have been doing is not only showing up to their school boards, mm-hmm. and, you know, getting their school boards to do what's right, but also we're already organizing and getting ready for the 2020 election. If we want to make things better for us, it's about who's sitting in those legislative seats when we come back in 2020. You know, we saw from this last election when educators got involved, we were able to help flip 12 House seats and 2 Senate seats. And that sent a strong message, which is why teacher pay and public education funding was at the forefront of this session, because the educators' voice was loud and clear. And we were going to continue to amplify our voice and organize our collective voice as educators, along with our parents who we work with side by side in the community, to make sure we get the right people back in Austin and change a few players who still are not, you know, wanting to fully fund our public schools.
All right, lawmakers, you hear that? Noel Candelaria is president of the Texas State Teachers Association. Thanks so much for taking a few minutes out to talk with us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
There's more of our special edition of the Texas Standard just ahead. Stay with us.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Rand Group, partnering with SAP to help mid-sized companies streamline operations such as CRM, finance, and procurement. More at randgroup.com. Software delivered as promised. No surprises. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at becomeacasa.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The congregation of West Freeway Church of Christ in White Settlement gathered for the first time last night since a gunman opened fire during a service Sunday. The shooting left 2 church members and the shooter dead. KERA's Christopher Conley reports.
The meeting inside was open only to church members, a chance to begin to mourn and pray together. Outside, at a candlelight vigil, dozens gathered to show support, including Jay Fannin.
Something sacred was violated, and that's what happened here Sunday.
Fannin is a youth pastor at the Wedgwood Baptist Church, less than 10 miles to the southeast. He was at that church 20 years ago when a gunman opened fire and killed 7 people. And he says dealing with something like this is hard, and it takes time.
Well, on day one, you can't process this. Nobody understands what took place. Nobody can really rationalize what has taken place because it's so raw.
Fannin said he'll continue praying for the West Freeway congregation and will be ready to help if they ask for it. I'm Christopher Connolly in Fort Worth.
While officer fatalities decreased by 18% nationwide this year, Texas saw an uptick in the number of deaths. According to a report the National Law Enforcement Officers Memorial Fund released Monday, there were 17 deaths in the state in 2019. 6 were firearms related. Marcia Ferranto is the group's CEO. She says they've found a link between firearms related deaths and domestic violence.
In fact, we have 3 areas that become the number one reason for the use of firearms, and domestic violence is one of those 3.
Earlier this month, Houston Police Sergeant Christopher Brewster was fatally shot while responding to a domestic violence call. Under a new state law, Texas University employees could face harsher penalties for failing to report sexual misconduct. Texas Public Radio's Lauren Terrazas has more on Senate Bill 212, which takes effect January 1st.
Texas lawmakers passed several bills this year aimed at confronting sexual violence on college campuses. Under SB 212, Title IX coordinators at Texas universities will be required to routinely summarize reports of sexual harassment, assault, stalking, or dating violence for university presidents. Those who fail to properly report such incidents could face termination and criminal charges, including up to 1 year in jail and a fine up to $4,000. I'm Lauren Terrazas in San Antonio.
And the end of 2019 closes a decade of major population growth in Texas. According to the latest estimates from the U.S. Census Bureau, Texas added roughly 3.85 million residents since 2010, more than any other state. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, working to strengthen public education for all students. More information at raiseyourhandtexas.org. The future of Texas is in our public schools.
You got to tune to the Texas Standard on New Year's Eve. Thanks so much for spending some of this special day with us. We're spending this hour recapping some of the biggest stories we covered in 2019. One of those included an extended look at water's role in our interconnected world. It's a series titled Drop by Drop. Earlier this year, the Standard's Joy Diaz took us to dinner to hear how what we order affects that most vital of resources.
I'm going to dinner to a pretend restaurant. In order to place you there, we need the right ambience. Now help me by using your imagination. The place is beautiful. The music relaxes the soul. The lights are dim, giving the long white tablecloths an orange glow. The menu in this place is different. There are no dollar prices here. Instead, I'll be paying with water. The amount of water it takes to produce the food on the menu. It's very weird to me, but not to my dinner partner.
There are some restaurants in Norway, in the UK also. When they give you the menu, it has also the water cost.
My dinner partner is University of Nebraska researcher Mesfin McConan. He's an expert in estimating what water experts call food's water footprint. Imagine if instead of paying for our dinner with money, we had to pay with the amount of water it costs to produce it. So no more cash or credit. Instead, we would haul along gallons of water. Should we try it just for today?
Okay.
I'm going to order a steak. Not a huge one, just 8 ounces. The cost? A little more than 850 gallons of water.
The water footprint of beef mostly comes from the grazing.
Dear God, come to realize I didn't bring enough water. But while we eat, I'll fill up some jugs to make up the difference. For a side dish, I'll have some pasta, 6 ounces. That will cost me almost 100 gallons of water.
Most of the water goes in production of wheat. The additional water is very, very small.
I think I can fill enough jugs during our meal to also pay for some asparagus, some coffee, and dessert. Whoa, 650 gallons for those last three. And most of it was for a few ounces of chocolate in the dessert.
Yep.
Coffee. To grow that coffee I drink at dinner, I'll need 35 gallons of water just for one cup.
Yeah. Some people advise you drink tea, which is a very low water footprint.
Yeah, but I don't want tea, and I'm afraid to come clean to Professor McConan, and yet he's so gracious.
The push to avoid coffee totally, that's difficult. It takes time. Do we need to avoid them totally? It's all work to improve how the farmers are using water. We may need to pay more so the farmers invest more on sustainable water use.
That's a thought. You know, this exercise is opening my eyes to how oblivious I've been to the cost of producing my meals. Because up until now, I understood the human cost that goes into my food, not just for the people who make it, but also for the people who produce it. And I also understood the carbon footprint that it takes to transport my food from one place to the other. But I had never seriously factored in the water cost.
Now I don't want to have dessert, but I really want to have dessert. And I want my dessert to have chocolate. Is that too much to ask?
Yeah, it's a lot of water. Chocolate.
It takes more water to produce 8 ounces of chocolate than it takes to produce 8 ounces of beef.
Yep, yeah, yeah. It comes at a big cost of water.
And I seriously thought coffee was a splurge. Okay, now to my dinner partner. What would you have for dinner?
I would go for lamb, pasta, cabbage, simple water.
Okay.
Plus coffee.
The water for his whole meal is less than what I used by ordering a steak. And coffee? Really? Can a water expert enjoy in good conscience a cup of coffee?
Coming from Ethiopia, where our major income comes, or most of the farmers' income comes from selling coffee, if everybody stopped coffee, what would be the farmers' income?
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that either. The meal was delicious.
Thank you for inviting me to be part of it.
And it's time to pay up. Let me step outside because I can't fit this much water inside a restaurant, even an imaginary one. So together, we spent almost 2,500 gallons of water. Forget the jugs. Our simple meal costs enough water to fill up a small pool. Whoa, I'll never look at a menu the same way, and I hope you won't either. I'm Joy Diaz for the Texas Standard.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Association of Community Colleges, providing pathways for Texans to advance the individual aspirations of students while focusing on accessibility, affordability, and relevance. More at tacc.org.
It's Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown, and as we look back on 2019, we're reminded of how much has changed in such a relatively short amount of time. Next year will mark a half century since the death of one of Port Arthur's most famous daughters. Sometime when you have a few minutes, get on Google and type in Dick Cavett and Janis Joplin. You'll come across a YouTube clip from the 1970s when Cavett was considered one of the most erudite talk show hosts on TV, and his guest, Janis Joplin, was a shooting star. Her look was pure San Francisco, iridescent pink feather boas, purple bell bottoms, and bracelets. But in that interview, she seemed to reveal something, a yearning to reconcile who she'd become with the girl who used to get picked on back in her Texas hometown.
Were you not surrounded by friends in high school?
They laughed me out of class, out of town, and out of the state. So I'm going home.
After her death to a heroin overdose a few months later at the age of 27, the tragedy of it all began to sink in. Fast forward to a few years ago, writer Holly George Warren was working at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And the more she learned about Janis's backstory, the more fascinated she became.
It just really intrigued me. How did this girl from a little town, you know, this Gulf Coast oil conservative town, Port Arthur, become the queen of rock and roll? I mean, really create this paradigm of front woman, lead singer, female rock star. How did she do that?
Joplin had released best-selling records with Big Brother and the Holding Company, but at the time of her death, she had taken the helm of a new recording with new musicians. Janis didn't live to see its release. That album, Pearl, would become her best-selling work. Holly George Warren says it wasn't until she got a chance to hear some of the production recordings that she realized what a force Janis had become.
I just thought she kind of painted this persona as being this just bluesy, just feeling it. She never talked about how hard she worked to get to where she was and to become the musician she was. And suddenly I hear her coming up with guitar parts, figuring out different tempos, new arrangements of the songs. I mean, she was really calling the shots.
Baby, you see? Do the second one. 2, 3, 4. You say that it's over, baby. You say that it's over, dear. But still you hang around. Come on, won't you move over?
But then you look at her growing up in Port Arthur, Texas,
and especially the social chaos that surrounded her. She seemed to have a supporting and loving family there, certainly earlier on as she dabbled in visual arts and that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, and I think that's what made her becoming an outcast in her town so hard, because she was beloved, she was popular, she did have friends, she had a very loving, supported family. She, you know, did very well at school, she got awards for her writing ability, and of course she was also a very talented painter. But once she read Jack Kerouac's On the Road, when it came out, once she discovered music that was pretty verboten in white neighborhoods in Port Arthur, which was blues music created by African American artists in a, you know, a very segregated town, segregated time, and she became obsessed with that music.
I'm gonna do one more. This is Bessie Smith's song.
When she started experimenting with her voice and realizing that she could project emotion and she could do this kind of a raw, rough kind of sound coming out of her throat, I think it really knocked her sideways and she wanted to pursue that. Now, this was still the era where most of the gals were wearing like the shirtwaist dresses, right, and bobby socks and loafers, right, and the bouffant beehive hairdos and everything. Janis was letting her hair hang down long. She was wearing a big floppy shirt, you know, over like tights, barefooted half the time. And Austin was when she first found her true, real community. Mm-hmm. That's when she first joined a little group called the Waller Creek Boys that were doing mostly like folk and bluegrass kind of stuff. But Janis introduced them to all these blues songs, which they added to their repertoire. Mm-hmm. And that's when she first started performing live and first gaining an audience. If I'm awake, if I'm dreaming love, da-da-da-da on my
mind. Janis is often thought of as a product of the Haight-Ashbury scene. Indeed, she'd made her first visit to San Francisco as a folk singer in the early 60s, escaping from small-town Texas as much as hoping to find more gigs. But after getting addicted to speed, she returned to Port Arthur and tried to start over. She swore she'd follow the straight life.
It did not last. The music was too much part of her. It was drawing her back.
Hon, I'm a mean, mean woman. I don't mean no one mean no good.
She actually got to be on a bill with 13th Floor Elevators when they first started.
Rocky
so she
Erickson.
Heard the great, late, great Rocky Erickson's incredible Banshee Wail, which would be an influence on her when she ended up moving to San Francisco in June of 66 and joining Big Brother and the Holding Company.
Yeah, but if you just want to go on drinking, honey, then won't you invite me along, please? Yeah. Hey. Oh, yeah.
And for the first time, playing in a band with electric instruments, you know, two really loud guitars, drums, bass, feedback, you know, so she had to find a new way to sing, and she really began to reinvent herself when she was in San Francisco.
Oh, no, I guess I'm just like a turtle. It's hiding underneath its whole shell.
Janis Joplin's return to San Francisco as psychedelic rock was taking hold would make her a superstar, one who yearned to get back to Texas and show her former classmates what she'd become. Janis Joplin died 49 years ago this month. The release of Pearl the following January was only a hint at what might have been.
I think she would have continued to experiment with different kinds of music. You know, of course, her version of Kris Kristofferson's Me and Bobby McGee was her first number one hit.
Freedom is just another word.
And she was already doing Sunday Morning Coming Down, another one of his great songs. And I'd like to imagine that she would continue doing some more of that kind of some people called cosmic country. I think she might have pursued that style for a while. But I think she also would have probably become a producer. She probably would have been one of the first ever, you know, women who was behind the boards in the studio. She wrote home to her parents letters describing all the minutiae of being in the recording studio as far back as 1966.
We can't do much more than just scratch the surface here in a short interview for the radio, but the book is Janis, Her Life in Music. Holly George Warren is the author. It's been a pleasure to get the chance to talk about Janis Joplin with you. Thank you so much for taking time to speak with us on the Texas Standard.
Well, thank you so much. I will talk Janis with you any old day.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU, dedicated to improving healthcare in North Texas and around the world through pursuits like the new TCU and UNTHSC School of Medicine, educating empathetic scholars. TCU, lead on.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. We've been spending this past hour looking back at some of the biggest news items affecting Texas and Texans over the past year. But for a moment, let's go back to 2017. Why? Well, because that was the year President Trump took office, and since that time, he's worked to dramatically reshape the country's immigration system, in particular, curbing migration at the U.S.-Mexico border. But in 2019, his administration implemented many substantial changes, and here to review those, KERA's Mallory Falk. She covers the border. Mallory, welcome back to the Texas Standard.
Hi, David. Thanks for having me.
As many of our listeners know, you're based in El Paso, and I recall this time last year, there were so many stories about asylum-seeking families being dropped off at local shelters, churches, even the Greyhound station. That's not happening anymore.
Yes, and there are a lot of reasons for that, but one major reason is a new policy called Migrant Protection Protocols, also known as the Remain in Mexico program. And that's the policy that forces asylum seekers to wait in Mexico while their cases play out in U.S. immigration court. It started in January in San Diego, and it's since expanded to many cities along the U.S.-Mexico border. It came to El Paso in the spring, and it's now in Texas cities, including Brownsville and Laredo. And the Trump administration says that this policy helps ensure that people with weak or fraudulent asylum claims aren't just released into the U.S., but the program has come under fierce criticism. Lawyers and advocates say it forces asylum seekers to wait in border cities with high rates of violence and where they themselves are specifically targeted. We've heard reports of migrants in the MPP program being kidnapped, raped, and extorted. A recent report from Human Rights First found more than 600 cases of violent crime against migrants in the Remain in Mexico program. And critics also say that when asylum seekers are forced to wait on the Mexico side of the border, it's much more difficult for them to access legal counsel and have a fair shot at winning asylum.
It's not the only new policy affecting asylum seekers either. There's also something called the asylum ban.
Yes, and this is the policy where if you passed through one or more countries on your way to the U.S.-Mexico border, you have to apply for asylum in one of those countries before you can pursue asylum in the U.S. Mm-hmm. So let's say you were fleeing from El Salvador and you traveled through Guatemala and Mexico to get to the U.S. border. Under this rule, you have to apply for asylum in Guatemala or Mexico. So this rule pretty much applies to anyone who arrives at the U.S.-Mexico border except for Mexicans. And people can still apply for two other forms of relief. One is called withholding of removal, and the other is called Convention Against Torture. But lawyers say that you have to clear a higher bar to win these forms of relief,
yeah.
And they don't offer the same level of protection and don't provide a path to citizenship.
As we mentioned, you're based in El Paso, and it's my understanding several new policies are being piloted there. Is that right?
That's right. And El Paso has really served as the testing ground for many immigration policies. back in 2017, there was a pilot family separation program here before that became a border-wide policy. And so what we're seeing right now are these two pilot programs that sort of speed up asylum decisions. One is called Prompt Asylum Claim Review, or PACER, and that applies generally to non-Mexicans. And the other, which applies to Mexicans, is called Humanitarian Asylum Review Process, or HARP. And the way it works is that migrants who are placed in these pilot programs are held in Customs and Border Protection facilities. They're given a short amount of time to call a lawyer before they're given what's called a credible fear interview, where they're screened for fear of persecution in their home countries. And if they don't pass those screenings, they can be pretty quickly deported. And so a lot of lawyers on the ground here are denouncing these programs. They say asylum seekers are being rushed through these screenings without access to legal counsel. Lawyers generally aren't allowed inside of the CBP facilities. And so they're saying that people who might otherwise pass these interviews with legal assistance instead are being sent back. And that these programs were kind of largely rolled out in secret. They didn't have time to prepare.
Of course, the other side of this, as I think the president and a lot of his supporters would say, is that these changes were put in place specifically to deal with a large numbers of migrants coming across the border. Those numbers do appear to be down. And what about the we were hearing about caravans coming from Central America, folks hoping to claim asylum in the United States?
Yeah, so it is true that numbers are down from earlier in this year. And, Department of Homeland Security officials have credited programs like migrant protection protocols for driving those numbers down. They're also crediting work that the Mexican government has done, placing military along the northern and southern border of Mexico as a way to sort of prevent asylum seekers from reaching the U.S. border. And so the Department of Homeland Security says these programs are successful and have led to a reduction in apprehensions at the U.S.-Mexico border compared to earlier this year.
What should we watch for next year?
So several of the policies we've discussed are currently being challenged in court. That includes the Remain in Mexico program. Earlier this month, ACLU brought litigation against the PACER and HARP pilot programs. And so in the coming year, I think everyone will be watching to see which of these policies gets shot down and which of them are allowed to stand and move forward. And in essence, watching to see how much more difficult or nearly impossible it might become for asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border to enter the United States and pursue their cases.
Mallory Falk is based in El Paso as a border correspondent for our partners at KERA, and you hear her quite often here on the Texas Standard. Mallory, thanks so much, and we sure do appreciate you getting us up to speed on conditions there along the border, and hope you have a wonderful holiday season.
Thanks. Same to you, David.
And you were listening to the Texas Standard. All right, one more time for 2019. Let's find out what Texans are talking about. Social media editor Wells Dunbar joins us. So, Wells, what do people have to say about the last
day? About the year that was?
Yeah.
Well, yeah, lots of folks chiming in about what they thought. Their picks were the biggest stories for the year were. And
okay.
We're seeing a mix of national and state-level stories via Facebook. Sherry Kleitz harkens back to the beginning of 2019 and the government shutdown. And then she recalls Trump's claim that the government workers could be potentially given credit at the grocery store. Don't think it was the president himself, but someone else in his administration. David Lee Beiser recalls a story that broke in the summer. He writes, children in cages in Texas, referring there to inhumane conditions documented in many immigrant detention facilities. Broca Sara Avial, she recalls the devastating tornadoes that hit the areas of North Texas in late October, that many people still recovering from. And Ed Scruggs cites the mass shootings in El Paso and Odessa.
Sure.
He says those tragedies unmasked the danger posed to this state by racist and extremist ideologies and our lax gun laws. Perhaps unsurprising, David, that when we think back to the biggest moments of the year, those seared in our memory may be those most shocking and painful moments in many instances. I know it may seem somewhat juvenile to hope for a brighter 2020, but I know that many people out there are.
That is certainly the case. We would love to hear your nominations for the top story of 2019. Keep them coming.
At Texas Standard is our handle on social media. We're out of time for the broadcast for 2019, but we'll be back next year, and we hope you'll join us till then. I'm David Brown, along with Wells Dunbar and the rest of the crew, wishing you a happy and safe New Year's Eve.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Wooldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.